with. Quicksilver, fascinating but impossible to predict. It could bear the ton of glass in the light, but try to put your finger on a drop of it and it would race away in any direction. The image kept coming to Tom's mind as he sat thinking about Isabel after Nucky's questioning. He thought back to the days after the last stillbirth when he'd tried to comfort her. We'll be all right. If it's just you and me for the rest of our lives, that's enough for me. Her eyes had slid up to meet his, and her expression chilled him. It was despairing, defeated. He moved to touch her, but she drew away. You'll get better. Things will get better, just give it time. Without warning, she stood up and rushed to the door, doubling up for a moment from pain before limping into the night. Izzy, for God's sake, stop. You'll hurt yourself. I'll do more than that. The moon balanced in the warm, windless sky. The long white nightgown Isabel had worn on their wedding night 4 years before glowed like a paper lantern as she stood, a tiny white dot in an ocean of darkness.
I can't bear it!
She screamed in a voice so loud and shrill that the goats started from their sleep and began to move with a jangle of bells in their paddock.
I can't bear it anymore! God, why do you make me live when my children die? I'd be better off dead!
She stumbled towards the cliff. He rushed to gather her into his arms. Calm down, Iz. But she broke free and ran again, half hobbling when the pain got too bad.
Don't tell me to calm down, you stupid, stupid man! It's your fault! I hate this place, I hate you! I want my baby!
The light scythed the path far above, leaving her untouched by its beam.
You didn't want him, that's why he died. He could tell you didn't care.
Come on, Iz. Come back inside. You don't feel anything, Tom Sherborne. I don't know what you did with your heart, but it's not inside you, that's for sure.
A person could only take so much. He'd seen it often enough. Lads who turned up full of ginger and ready to give Fritz hell, who survived the shelling and the snow and the lice and the mud for years sometimes. And something in them just packed up and went home, went somewhere deep inside where they couldn't be touched. Or sometimes they turned on you and came at you with a bayonet, laughing like a maniac and crying at the same time. Christ, when he thought back to his own state by the time it was all over. Who was he to judge Isabel? She'd reached her edge, that was all. Everyone had one. Everyone. And in taking Lucy away, he'd driven her to it. Late that night, Septimus Potts pulled off his boots and wiggled his toes in his fine woolen socks. He groaned at the familiar creaking of his back. He was sitting on the side of the solid jarrah bed, carved out of a tree from his own forest. The only sound in the enormous room was the ticking of the carriage clock on the nightstand. He gave a sigh as he took in the finery, the starched linen, the gleaming furniture, the portrait of his late wife Ellen by the light of the electric lamps shaded by frosted rose glass. The image of his granddaughter, distraught and cowering that afternoon, was still vivid. Baby Grace, given up for dead by everyone but Hannah. Life. Who the bloody hell could tell how it was going to turn out? That distress, that despair of the loss of a mother. He never imagined he would see it again after Ellen's death, until confronted by his granddaughter in the garden. Just when he thought he'd seen all the tricks life could play, out it came with a new one, like an evil card sharp. He knew what the little girl was going through. A doubt seeped into the corner of his mind. Perhaps it was cruel to keep her from the Sherborne girl. He looked again at the portrait of Ellen. Grace had the same jawline. Maybe she would grow up to be as beautiful as her grandmother. He wandered off into the imaginings of Christmases and birthdays along the way. A happy family, that's all he wanted. He thought of Hannah's tortured face, remembered with guilt the same look when he tried to stop her marrying Frank. No, this was the place for the child, with her true family. She'd have the top brick off the chimney. Eventually she'd get used to her real home and a real mother, if Hannah could just bear up that long. He felt tears in his eyes and anger fought its way to the surface. Someone should pay, someone should be made to suffer the way his daughter had been made to suffer. Who could possibly come across a tiny baby and keep her like a driftwood souvenir? He drove out the intrusive doubt. He couldn't change the past and the years he had refused to acknowledge Frank's existence, but he could make it up to Hannah now. Sherburne would be punished, he would see to it. He switched off the lamp, watching the moonlight glimmer on the silver framing Ellen's photograph. And he pushed away thoughts of what the Grays Marks must be feeling that night. Chapter 27. Since her return, Isabel found herself constantly on the lookout for Lucy. Where had she got to? Was it time for bed? What would she give her for lunch? Then her brain would correct her, remind her how things were now, and she would go through the agony of loss all over again. What was happening to her daughter? Who was feeding her and dressing her? Lucy would be beside herself. The image of the little girl's face as she was forced to swallow the bitter sleeping draught made Isabel's throat tighten. She tried to blot it out with other memories, Lucy playing in the sand, Lucy holding her nose as she jumped into the water, her face as she slept at night, at ease, safe, perfect. There was no more wonderful sight in the world than your child sleeping. Isabel's whole body bore the imprint of the little girl. Her fingers knew the smoothness of her hair as she brushed it. Her hips remembered the weight of her and the tight locking of her legs around her waist, the warm softness of her cheek. While she wandered through these scenes, sucking comfort from them like a nectar from a dying flower, she was aware of something dark behind her, something she could not bear to look at. It would come to her in dreams, blurred and dreadful. It would call to her. Izzy! Izzy! Love! She could not turn around and her shoulders would shoot up to her ears as if to escape a grasp. She would awaken breathless and sick to the stomach. All the while Isabel's parents took her silence for misplaced loyalty. "There's nothing I can say," were her only words that day she first came home, and she repeated them whenever Bill and Violet tried to broach the subject of Tom and what had happened. The cells at the back of the police station usually had to do no more than keep a drunk long enough to sleep it off, or give an angry husband time to see sense and promise not to take his temper out with his fists. Half the time, whoever was on duty didn't bother to lock the cell door. And if it was someone they knew, on a shift that was dragging, more often than not, they'd have them out in the office playing cards on the strict understanding that they wouldn't try to shoot through. Today, Harry Garstone was particularly excited, at last in charge of a serious criminal. He was still spitting chips that he'd been off duty that night a year ago when they brought in Bob Hitching from Kerrydale. A fellow never had been right in the head since Gallipoli. Got carried away with a meat cleaver and did in his brother from the next door farm, because they didn't see eye to eye over their mother's well. Ended up swinging for it. So now, Garstone was delighting in the niceties of procedure. He got the rule book out to check that he was following it to the letter. When Ralph had asked to see Tom, the constable had made a great show of consulting the book, sucking his teeth and sliding a pout from one side of his letterbox mouth to the other. "Sorry, Captain Addicott. I wish I could let you, but it says here, 'Don't give me any of your nonsense, Harry Garstone, or I'll be on to your mother.' It's quite specific and..." The walls in the station were thin, and the constable was interrupted by the voice of Vernon Nucky, who rarely bothered to rise for his seat for such communications. "Don't be so bloody wet, Garstone. It's the lighthouse keeper in the cell, not Ned bloody Kelly. Let the man through." The deflated constable gave the keys a vigorous jangle in protest as he led Ralph through a locked door, down some stairs and along a dark corridor, till he arrived at a few cells with bars. In one of them, Tom sat on a canvas bunk that folded out from the wall. He took in Ralph's face, drawn and grey. "Tom," said the skipper. "Ralph." Tom gave a nod. "Came as soon as I could. Hilda says hello," he said. "And Blue," emptying his pockets of greetings like small change. Tom nodded again. The two sat in silence. After a while, Ralph said, "If you'd rather I left you." No, it's good to see you. Just not much to say. Sorry." "All right, if we don't talk for a bit?" Ralph was full of questions, both his own and his wife's, but he sat out the silence on a rickety chair. The day was warming up, and the wooden walls creaked like a creature stretching as it awoke. Honey-eaters and willy-wagtails chirruped outside. Once or twice a vehicle sputtered down the road, drowning out the clicking of the crickets and the cicadas. Thoughts clamoured in Ralph's mind and made it to his tongue, but he managed to stop them just in time. He put his hands under his thighs to overcome his urge to shake Tom by the shoulders. Unable to resist any longer, he finally barked out.
God's name, Tom, what's going on? What's all this about Lucy being the Roenfelt baby?
It's true.
But how? What in hell?
I've explained it to the police, Ralph. I'm not proud of what I've done.
Is this what you were talking about, putting right that time on Janus?
It's not as simple as that. There was a long pause.
Tell me what happened.
Not much point, Ralph. I made a bad decision back then. It's time for me to pay for it.
Oh, for God's sake, boy, at least let me help you.
No, there's nothing you can do. I'm in this one alone.
Whatever you've done, you're a good man, and I won't see you go down like this.
He stood up.
Let me get you a decent lawyer, see what he makes of it all.
Not much a lawyer can do now either, Ralph. A priest might be more use.
It's all tommy rot what's being said about you.
Not all of it, Ralph.
You tell me straight to my face that this was all your doing, that you threatened Isabel. You look me in the eye and tell me, and I'll leave you in peace, boy.
Tom inspected the grain of the timber in the wall.
You see, exclaimed Ralph in triumph, you can do no such thing.
I was the one with the duty, not her.
Tom looked at Ralph and considered if there was anything at all he could tell him, explain to him without jeopardizing Isabel. Finally, he said,
Izzy's suffered enough. She can't take any more.
Putting yourself in the firing line's no way of dealing with it. This has all got to be sorted out properly.
There's no sorting out, Ralph, and there's no going back. I owe her this.
Miracles were possible. It was official. In the days following Grace's return, Reverend Norkels experienced a decided increase in his congregation, particularly amongst the women folk. Many a mother who had given up hope of seeing a darling son again, and many a war widow, took to prayer with renewed vigour, no longer feeling foolish about praying for the hopeless. St. Jude had never received so much attention. Dull aches of loss reawakened as raw longing was soothed by that balm so long exhausted, hope. Gerald Fitzgerald was sitting opposite Tom, the table between them strewn with papers and pink legal tape from the brief. Tom's lawyer was short and balding like a jockey in a three-piece suit, wiry but nimble. He had come down on the train from Perth the night before, and he had read the brief over dinner at the Empress.
You've been formally charged. Partageurs gets a circuit magistrate every 2 months, and he's just been, so he'll be held in custody here until he's back. You're a damn sight better off in remand here than Albany Jail, that's for sure. We'll use the time to prepare for the committal hearing.
Tom looked at him with a question.
That's the preliminary hearing to decide whether you've got a case to answer. If you have, you'll get committed for trial in Albany or Perth. Depends.
On what? Asked Tom.
Let's go through the charges, said Fitzgerald, and you'll find out.
Once again he cast his eye over the list before him.
Well, they've certainly spread the net wide enough. WA Criminal Code, Commonwealth Public Service Act, WA Coroner's Act, Commonwealth Crimes Act. A real dog's breakfast of state and Commonwealth charges.
He smiled and rubbed his hands together.
That's what I like to see.
Tom raised an eyebrow.
Means they're scraping around, not sure what they can get you on, the lawyer went on. Neglect of statutory duty, that's 2 years and a fine. Improperly dealing with a body, 2 years hard labour. Failing to report a dead body, well, he scoffed. That's just a £10 fine. Making a false statement to register a birth, 2 years hard labour and a £200 fine.
He scratched his chin. Tom ventured. What about the child-stealing charge? It was the first time he had used the phrase, and he flinched at the sound of the words.
Section 343 of the Criminal Code, 7 years hard labour.
The lawyer screwed up his mouth and nodded to himself.
Your advantage, Mr. Sherborne, is that the law covers the usual. Statutes are drafted to catch what happens most of the time. So Section 343 applies to, he picked up a dog-eared statute and read from it, any person who with intent to deprive any parent of the possession of a child, forcibly or fraudulently, takes or entices away or detains the child. Well, Tom asked.
Well, I never get up on that. Luckily for you, most of the time babies don't leave their mothers unless someone takes them away. And they don't usually find their way to barely inhabited islands, you see? They can't make out the necessary elements of the offence. You didn't detain the baby, legally speaking, she could have left any time she wanted. You certainly didn't entice her away, and they can never prove intention to deprive because we'll say you honestly believe the parents were dead. So I reckon I can get you off that one. And you're a war hero. Military cross and bar. Most courts will still go easy on a bloke who risked his life for his country and never had a whiff of trouble.
Tom's face relaxed, but the lawyer's expression changed as he continued.
But what they don't like, Mr. Sherborne, is a liar. In fact, they dislike it so much that the penalty for perjury is 7 years hard labour. And if that liar stops the real culprit getting what's coming to them, then that's perverting the course of justice, and that's another 7 years. Do you get my drift?
Tom gave him a look.
The law likes to make sure that the right people are getting punished. Judges are a bit particular about that sort of thing.
He stood up and wandered to the window, gazing through the bars into the trees beyond.
Now, if I walked into a court and told a story of a poor woman beside herself with grief over the loss of her stillborn baby, a woman who wasn't right in the head for a bit, couldn't tell right from wrong, and if I told the story of how her husband, who was a decent bloke, had always done his duty, but who, just this once, trying to make things better for his wife, let his heart get the better of his common sense, and went along with her idea, well, I could sell that to a judge, I could sell it to a jury. The court's got what we call the prerogative of mercy, the right to impose a lesser sentence for the wife, too. But at the moment, I've got a man who, by his own admission, is not only a liar, but a bully. A man who, presumably worried that people will think he's got no lead in his pencil, decides to keep a tiny baby and forces his wife to lie about it.
Tom straightened his back. I've said what I've said. Fitzgerald continued.
Now, if you're the sort of man who really would do something like that, then, for all the police know, you're the sort of person who might go even a step further to get what you want. If you're the sort of man who takes what he wants because he can, and who's prepared to make his wife act under duress, then perhaps you're the sort of man who's prepared to kill to get what he wants. We all know you did enough for that during the war.
He paused.
That's what they might say. They haven't charged me with that. So far. But from what I hear, that copper from Albany is dying to get his hands on you. I've come across him before, and I can tell you he's a right bastard.
Tom took a deep breath and shook his head.
And he's very excited that your wife won't corroborate your story about Roanevelt being dead when you found him.
He twirled the crimson tape from the brief around his finger.
She must really hate your guts.
As he unwound it, he said slowly,
Now, she could hate your guts because you made her lie about keeping a baby, or even because you killed a man. But I reckon it's more likely she hates your guts because you gave the game away.
Tom made no response.
It's up to the Crown to prove how he died. With a bloke who's been underground for nearly 4 years, it's no easy task. Not that much left of him. No broken bones, no fractures, documented history of heart trouble. Normally that would probably lead to an open verdict by the coroner, if you came clean and told the whole truth.
If I plead guilty to all the charges, Sam made Isabel go along with me, and there's no other evidence. No one can touch her, is that right?
Yes, but...
And I'll take what's coming to me.
Trouble is, there might be a lot more coming to you than you bargained for,
Fitzgerald said as he put the papers back in his briefcase.
We've got no idea what your wife's going to say, you did or didn't do, if she ever decides to talk. If I were in your shoes, I'd be doing some damned hard thinking.
If people used to stare at Hannah before she got Grace back, they stared a lot harder afterwards. They'd expected some sort of miraculous transformation, like a chemical reaction, as the mother and daughter met. But they were disappointed on that score. The child looked distressed and the mother distraught. Far from getting a bloom back in her cheeks, Hannah grew more gaunt, as every one of Grace's screams made her wonder whether she'd done the right thing in reclaiming her. Old logbooks from Janice had been requisitioned by the police as they examined the handwriting on the letters to Hannah. There was no mistaking the sure, steady penmanship in both. Nor was there any question as to the rattle Bluey had identified. It was the baby herself who had altered beyond recognition. Hannah had handed Frank a tiny dark-haired infant weighing 12 pounds, and fate had handed back to her a frightened, willful blonde changeling who could stand on her own 2 feet, walk and scream until her face was scarlet and her chin wet with tears and dribble. The confidence Hannah had gained in handling her baby in the first weeks of her life was swiftly eroded. The rhythms of intimacy, the unspoken understandings, which she had assumed she could just pick up again, were lost to her. The child no longer responded in a way she could predict. They were like two dancers whose steps were foreign to one another. Hannah was terrified by the moments when she lost patience with her daughter, who at first would eat and sleep and be bathed only after pitched battles, and later simply withdrew into herself. In none of her years of daydreams or even her nightmares had her imagination managed anything as awful as this. In desperation, she took the child to Dr. Sumpton. "Well," said the rotund doctor as he put his stethoscope back on his desk, "physically she's perfectly healthy." He pushed the jar of jelly beans in Grace's direction. "Help yourself, young lady." The girl, still terrified from her first encounter with him at the police station, stayed mute, and Hannah offered her the jar. "Go on. Any colour you like, darling." But her daughter turned her head away and took up a strand of hair to curl around her finger. "And she's been wetting the bed, you say?" "Often. At her age, surely you'd normally expect. You hardly need me to remind you that these aren't normal circumstances." He rang a bell on his desk, and after a discreet knock, a white-haired woman entered. "Mrs. Fripp, take little Grace out to sit with you while I have a word with her mother, would you?" The woman smiled. "Come on, dear. Let's see if we can find a biscuit for you somewhere," she said, and led the listless child away. Hannah began. "I don't know what to do, what to say. She still keeps asking for," she stumbled, "for Isabel Sherborne." "What have you said about her?" "Nothing. I've told her that I'm her mother and I love her and..." "Well, you have to say something about Mrs. Sherborne."
"But what?"
"My suggestion is that you tell her that she and her husband had to go away."
"Go away where? Why?"
"It doesn't really matter at that age, just as long as she has an answer for a question. She'll forget, eventually. If there's nothing to remind her of the Sherbornes, she'll get used to a new home. I've seen it often enough with adopted orphans and so forth. But she gets in such a state, I just want to do the right thing for her." "You don't make omelettes without breaking eggs, I'm afraid, Mrs. Roanfelt. Fate's dealt this little girl a pretty tough set of cards, and there's nothing you can do about that. Eventually those two will fade from her mind, as long as she doesn't keep in contact with them. And in the meantime, give her a drop of the sleeping draught. She's too anxious and unsettled. It won't do her any harm."
Chapter 28.
"You stay away from that man, you hear me?"
"I've got to go and see him, Ma. He's been in the lock-up for ages, and this is all my fault," lamented Bluey.
"Don't talk rubbish. You've reunited a baby with a mother, and you're about to pocket 3,000 guineas reward."
Mrs. Smart took the iron from the stove and pressed the tablecloth harder with each sentence.
"Use your loaf, boy. You've done your bit now. Just keep out of it."
"He's in more trouble than the early settlers, Ma. I don't reckon this is going to turn out too good for him."
"That's not your lookout, sonny. Now get out the back and get on with the weeding of the rose bed."
By reflex, Bluey took a step towards the back door as his mother muttered,
"Ah, to have been left with a half-wit son."
He stopped and, to her astonishment, pulled himself up to his full height.
"Yeah, well, I may be a half-wit, but I'm not a dobber. And I'm not the sort of bloke that deserts his mates."
He turned and headed for the front door.
"Just where do you think you're going, Jeremiah Smart?"
"Out, Ma.
Over my dead body,"
she snapped, blocking his way. She was all of 5 feet tall. Bluey topped 6 foot.
"Sorry," he said as he picked his mother up by the waist as easily as a piece of sandalwood and put her down lightly to one side.
He left her, jaw agape, eyes flaming, as he walked out the door and down the front path. Bluey took in the scene. The tiny space, a slop bucket in the corner, a
tin mug on a table that was bolted to the floor. In all the years he'd known Tom, he'd never seen him unshaven, never seen his hair uncombed, his shirt creased. Now he had dark gullies under his eyes and his cheekbones rose like ridges above his square jaw.
"Tom! Good to see you, mate," declared the visitor in a phrase that brought them both back to the days of jetty landings and long voyages, when they were truly glad to see one another.
Bluey tried to look at Tom's face but could not negotiate the space between the bars. So either the face or the bars were out of focus. He searched for a few moments before coming up with,
"How are things?"
"Not been better."
Bluey fidgeted with the hat in his hands until he screwed up his courage.
"I'm not going to take the reward, mate."
The words tumbled out.
"Wouldn't be right."
Tom looked off to his side for a moment. "Thought there must have been a reason you didn't come out with the troopers." He sounded uninterested rather than angry.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Ma made me do it. I never should have listened to her. I wouldn't touch the money with a barge pole."
"Might as well be you, gets it to some other bloke. Makes no difference to me now." Whatever Blue was expecting from Tom, it was not this indifference.
"What happens next?"
"Bugger if I know, Blue.
Is there anything you need? Anything I can get you?"
"Bit of sky and some ocean would be nice."
"I'm serious."
"So am I." Tom took a deep breath as he considered a thought. "There is something you could do. You could look in on Izzy for me. She'll be at her parents. Just see she's okay. She'll be taking it hard. Lucy meant the world to her." And he stopped because a crack had found its way into his voice. "Tell her I understand, that's all. Tell her I understand, Bluey." Though the young man felt utterly out of his depth, he took his commission like a sacred charge. He would convey the message as if his own life depended on it. Once Bluey had gone, Tom lay down in his bunk and wondered again how Lucy was, how Isabel was coping. He tried to think of any other way he could have done things, starting from that very first day. Then he remembered Ralph's words.
"No point fighting your war over and over until you get it right."
Instead, he sought comfort in perspective. In his mind's eye, he mapped out on the ceiling the exact position the stars would be in that night. Starting with Sirius, always the brightest, the Southern Cross, then the planets, Venus and Uranus, all easily visible in the sky over the island. He traced the constellations as they slid their way across the roof of the world from dusk till dawn. The precision of it, the quiet orderliness of the stars, gave him a sense of freedom. There was nothing he was going through that the stars had not seen before, somewhere, sometime on this earth. Given enough time, their memory would close over his life like healing a wound. All would be forgotten, all suffering erased. Then he remembered the star atlas and Lucy's inscription, "Forever and ever and ever," and the pain of the present flooded back. He said a prayer for Lucy. "Keep her safe. Let her have a happy life, let her forget me. And for Isabel lost in the darkness. Bring her home, back to herself before it's too late." Bluey shuffled his feet and silently rehearsed his speech again as he stood at the Grey's Mark's front door. When it opened, Violet stood before him, her face wary.
"Can I help you?" she asked, the formality a shield against any new unpleasantness.
"Afternoon, Mrs. Graysmark."
But she made no acknowledgement, he said.
"I'm Blue... Jeremiah Smart."
"I know who you are.
I wonder if... Do you think I could have a word with Mrs. Sherborne? She's not up to visitors."
"I..."
He was about to give up, but remembered Tom's face and persisted.
"I won't hold her up, I'll just have to..."
Isabel's voice drifted out from the darkened lounge room.
"Let him in, Ma."
Her mother scowled.
"You'd better come through. Mind you wipe your feet."
She stared at his boots while he wiped and wiped them again on the brushed doormat before following her. It's all right, Ma. No need to stay, said Isabel from her chair.
Isabel looked as bad as Tom, Bluey thought, grey-skinned and empty.
Thanks for seeing me, he faltered.
The rim of his hat was damp where he clutched it.
I've been to see Tom.
Her face clouded and she turned away.
He's in a real bad way, Mrs. S. Real bad way.
And he sent you to tell me that, did he?
Bluey continued to fidget with his hat. No. He asked me to give you a message.
Oh?
He said to tell you he understands.
She could not keep the surprise from her face. Understands what?
Didn't say, just said to tell you.
Her eyes remained fixed on Bluey, but she was not looking at him. After a long time, in which she blushed deeper at being stared at, she said,
Well then, you've told me.
She rose slowly to her feet.
I'll show you out. But,
well? Asked Bluey, shocked.
Well, what? What should I tell him back? I mean, a message or something?
She didn't answer.
He's always been good to me, Mrs. S. You both have.
Through here, she said, guiding him to the front door. As she closed it behind him, she leaned her face against the wall, shaking.
Oh, Isabel, darling, her mother exclaimed. Come and have a lie down. There's a girl, she said, and led her to her room.
I'm going to be sick again, said Isabel, and Violet manoeuvred the old china basin onto her daughter's lap just in time. Bill Graysmark prided himself on being a good judge of people. As a headmaster, he got to observe human character in the process of formation. He was rarely wrong about which ones would do well for themselves in life, and which one would come a cropper. Nothing in his gut told him Tom Sherborne was a liar or a violent man. Just to see him with Lucy was enough to show that the child hadn't the least fear of him. And he couldn't have asked for someone to cherish his daughter more. But, having lost the only grandchild he would ever have, Bill's loyalty was to his one surviving child. His instinctive judgment was elbowed aside. Blood was thicker than water. God knows he'd learned that the hard way.
It's a terrible business, Vernon. Terrible business. Poor Isabel's a wreck, he said as they sat in the corner of the pub. As long as she gives evidence against Tom, said Nucky, she's got nothing to worry about.
Bill questioned him with a look.
She's not criminally liable for anything he made her do, so she just needs to put her side of the story. She's what we call competent but not compellable, as a witness for this sort of case, the policeman explained. Her evidence is admissible, the court says it's as good as anyone's, but you can't force a wife to testify against her husband. And of course he's got the right to remain silent. We can't make him say anything against her either, if he doesn't want to, and he's made it quite clear he's not going to say a word.
He paused.
Isabel, did she ever seem, well, uneasy about the child?
Bill shot him a glance.
Let's not get dragged off the point here, Vernon.
Nucky let it pass. He mused aloud.
Being a lighthouse keeper's a position of trust, you know. Our whole country, the whole world, if you want to look at it that way, depends on them being men of good character. Honest. Decent. We can't have them running around falsifying government records, coercing their wives, let alone doing whatever it was he did to Frank Rowenfelt before he buried him.
He registered the alarm on Bill's face, but continued.
No. Best to put a stop to that sort of thing right away. The magistrate will be here in a few weeks for the committal hearing. Given what Sherborne's said so far, well, he'll probably be sent to Albany, where the court's got the power to dish out harsher penalties. Or they could really take against him and drag him up to Perth. Spragg's looking for any hint that the fellow wasn't dead when he reached Janus.
As he drained the last of his beer, he said,
Things don't look good for him, Bill, I can tell you that much.
Do you like books, darling? Hannah ventured. She'd been trying everything she could think of to build a bridge with her daughter. She herself had loved the stories as a child, and one of the few memories she could still muster of her own mother was being read the tale of Peter Rabbit, one sunny afternoon on the lawns of Bermondsey. She remembered clearly the pale blue silk of her mother's blouse, the scent she wore, something floral and rare, and her mother's smile, the greatest treasure of all. "What's that word?" she was asking Hannah. "You know that word, don't you?" "Carrot," Hannah had proclaimed proudly. "Clever Hannah," her mother had smiled. "You're as bright as a button." The memory faded out there like the end of a story, so she would start it again over and over. Now she tried to tempt Grace with the same book. "You see, it's about a rabbit. Come and read it with me." The child looked at her sullenly. "I want my mama. I hate the book." "Oh, come on, you haven't even looked at it." She took a breath and tried again. "Just one page. Let's read one page, and if you don't like it, we'll stop." The girl snatched the book from her hands and threw it at her, the corner striking Hannah's cheek, narrowly missing her eye. Then she darted from the room, running straight into Gwen, who was coming in at the same moment. "Hey, hey there, missy," said Gwen. What have you done to Hannah? Go and say sorry." "Leave her be, Gwen," said Hannah. "She didn't mean any harm. It was an accident." She picked up the book and put it carefully on the shelf. "I thought I might try her with some chicken soup for dinner tonight." "Everyone likes chicken soup, don't they?" she asked without much conviction. Hours later, she was on her hands and knees, mopping up the soup her daughter had vomited on the floor. "When you think about it, what did we ever really know about him? All the stories about being from Sydney, that could all be a furphy. All we know for certain is he's not from Pas de Gers." Violet Graysmark was speaking to Bill when their daughter was safely asleep. "What sort of a man is he? Waits until she can't live without the child, then whisks her away." Her eyes were on the framed photograph of her granddaughter. She had removed it from the mantelpiece and was stowing it under the linen in her underwear drawer. "But, Will, what do you make of it, Vi, really?" "Oh, for heaven's sake. Even if he didn't hold a gun to her head, he's still responsible." She was clearly beside herself with losing that third baby, and to blame her for it. It was up to him to stick to the rules then and there, if that's what he was going to do. Not start backtracking years later when so many people were affected. "We live with the decisions we make, Bill. That's what bravery is, standing by the consequences of your mistakes." Bill said nothing as she rearranged the dainty bags of lavender. She continued. It was rubbing salt in the wound. Put his own guilty conscience above what it would do to Isabel or Lucy or... She put her hands on his. "To us, for that matter, dear. Not a thought for any of us in this business, as if we hadn't had enough to deal with along the way." A tear glistened in her eye. "Our little granddaughter, Bill. All that love." She closed the drawer slowly. "Come on, bye, dear, I know it's hard on you." "I know," said her husband. He hugged his wife close, noticing her hair was shot through with grey these days. The two of them stood in the embrace. Violet weeping, Bill saying, "I was such a fool to believe the bad days were over." Without warning, a great sob escaped him, and he hugged her tighter still, as if it might physically halt this new shattering of his family. Having cleaned up the floor and with her daughter finally asleep, Hannah sits by the little bed and gazes at her. In the day it is impossible. Grace hides her face if she thinks she's being watched. She turns her back or runs into another room. Now by the light of a single candle, Hannah can observe every aspect of her. And in the curve of her cheek and the shape of her eyebrow, she sees Frank. It makes her heart swell, and she can almost believe that if she spoke to the sleeping figure, it would be Frank who answered. The flame-throwing shadows that twitch with the rhythm of her daughter's breath catches the golden glint of her hair. The glistening of a fine filament of dribble that trails from the corner of the translucent pink mouth. Hannah is only slowly aware of the wish that has formed itself at the back of her mind, that Grace could stay asleep for days, for years, if need be, until all memory of those people, of that life, has ebbed away. She feels that peculiar hollowness inside her which came the first time she saw distress on the face of the returned child. If only Frank were here. He would know what to do, how to get through this. No matter how many times life knocked him down, he was always straight back on his feet, with a smile, no hard feelings. Hannah casts her mind back to see a tinier figure, a perfect baby a week old. And here's again Frank's lullaby. Schlaf, Kindlein, schlaf. Sleep, little child, sleep. She recalls the way he would gaze into the cot and whisper to her in German. I'm whispering good things for her dreams, he would say. As long as one has good things in the mind, one can be happy. This I know. Now Hannah straightens her back. Just the memory is enough to give her courage to face the next day. Grace is her daughter. Something in the child's soul will surely remember, recognize her eventually. She just needs to take things a day at a time, as her father says. Soon enough the little girl will be hers again, will be the joy she was on the day she was born. Quietly she blows out the candle and makes her way from the room by the light which slides along the floor from the open door. When she climbs into her own bed, she is struck by how empty it feels. Isabel paces. It is 3 o'clock in the morning and she has slipped out through the back door of her parents' house. A ghost gum has trapped the moon between two of its long branches like spindly fingers. The dry grass crackles faintly under her bare feet as she walks on it. From the jacaranda to the flame tree, from the flame tree to the jacaranda. The place of the old wicket all those years ago. She's flicking in and out of understanding, in and out of being in that fluttering of thoughts that originally came with the loss of her first baby, and grew with the snatching away of two more, and now Lucy. And the Tom she loved, the Tom she married, has disappeared too into the fog of deceit. Slipping away when she wasn't looking, running off with notes to another woman, plotting to take her daughter away. I understand. Tom's message is puzzling. Her gut tightens in a knot of fury and longing. Her thoughts fly out in all directions, and just for a moment she has a bodily memory of being 9 on a runaway horse. The tiger snake on the track. A sudden rearing and off-the-horse shot between the trunks, heedless of the branches and the child clinging desperately to its mane. Isabel had lain flat against its neck until its fear and muscles were exhausted, and it finally came to a halt in a clearing nearly a mile away. "There's nothing you can do," Father said. "Once a horse bolts, you can only say your prayers and hang on for all you're worth. Can't stop an animal that's caught in a blind terror." There's no one she can talk to, no one who will understand. What sense can her life make by itself without the family she lived for? She runs her fingers over the bark of the jacaranda and finds the scar, the mark Alfie carved in it to show her height, the day before he and Hugh left for France. "Now I'll be checking how much you've grown when we come back, sis, so mind you get on with it." "When will you be back, really?" she'd asked. Boys had shot one another a look, both worried and excited. "By the time you reach here," Hugh had said, and nicked the bark 6 inches higher. "Once you get there, we'll be home to bother you again, Bella." She never grew that tall. A scurrying of a gecko brings her back to the present, back to her predicament. The questions harangue her as the moon languishes in the branches above. Who is Tom, really? This man she thought she knew so well. How could he be capable of such betrayal? What has her life with him been? And who were the souls, that blending of her blood with his, who failed to find their way into being within her? A goblin thought jumps onto her shoulder. What's the point of tomorrow? The weeks following Grace's return were more harrowing for Hannah than the weeks following her loss, as she was faced with truths which, long pushed away, were now inescapable. Years really had passed. Frank really was dead. Part of her daughter's life had gone and could never be brought back. While Grace had been absent from Hannah's days, she had been present in someone else's. Her child had lived a life without her, without, she caught herself thinking, a moment's thought for her. With shame she realized she felt betrayed by a baby. She remembered Billy Wishart's wife and how her joy at the return of her husband, she had believed dead on the Somme, had turned to despair. The gas victim who came home to her was as much a stranger to himself as to his family, After struggling for 5 years, one morning when the ice was thick on the water in their tank, she had stood on an upturned milking bucket in the cowshed and hanged herself, leaving her children to cut her down because Billy still couldn't grip a knife. Hannah prayed for patience and strength and understanding. Every morning she asked God to help her get through the end of the day. One afternoon as she was passing the nursery, she heard a voice. She slowed her pace and tiptoed closer to the door, which was ajar. She felt a thrill to see her daughter playing with her dolls at last. All her attempts to get her to play had been rejected. Now pieces of a toy tea set were strewn about on the bed covers. One doll still wore its exquisite lace dress, but the others had been stripped down to a camisole and long bloomers. On the lap of the one with the skirt lay a wooden clothes peg. "Dinner time," said the skirted doll, as a child held the tiny teacup to the clothes peg and made mmm-mmm-mmm noises. "Good little girl. Now time for bed, sweetie. Nye-nye." And the doll lifted the peg to its lips to kiss it. "Look, Dada," it went on. "Lucy's sleeping," as it touched the clothes peg with a dainty hand. "Good night, Lulu. Good night, Mama," said the doll in bloomers. "Got to light up now. Sun's nearly down." And off the doll trotted under the blanket. The doll with the skirt said, "Don't worry, Lucy. The witch can't catch you. I made her dead." Before she knew what she was doing, Hannah marched in and snatched the dolls away. "That's enough of those silly games, you hear me?" she snapped and smacked her daughter's hand. The child's limbs stiffened, but she did not cry. She just watched Hannah silently. Instantly, Hannah was flooded with remorse. "Darling, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to hurt you." She remembered the doctor's instructions. "They've gone, those people. They did a bad thing keeping you away from home, and they've gone now." Grace looked puzzled at the mention of home, and Hannah sighed. One day it'll make sense." By lunchtime, as Hannah sobbed in the kitchen, ashamed of her outburst, her daughter was playing the game again with three clothes pegs instead. Hannah stayed up late into the night, stitching and cutting, so that in the morning the child awoke to a new rag doll and a pillow. A little girl with Grace embroidered on her pinafore. "I can't bear the thought of what it must be doing to her, Ma," said Isabel as the two women sat together in wicker chairs under the eaves at the back of the house. "She'll be missing us. Missing home. Poor little thing won't know what on earth's going on." "I know, dear, I know," replied her mother. Violet made her a cup of tea, settled it on her lap. The daughter had altered dreadfully. Sunken eyes shadowed beneath in grey, hair dull and tangled. Isabel spoke aloud the thought that had occurred to her, perhaps to understand it better. "There's never been a funeral." What do you mean?" asked Violet. Isabel was not making much sense these days. "Everyone I've lost. They've just been ripped away into nothing. Maybe a funeral would have made a difference. With Hugh there's the photo of the grave in England. Alfie's just a name on that memorial. My first three babies. 3, Mum. Never had so much as a hymn sung for them, and now..." Her voice broke into tears. "Lucy!" Violet had been glad she'd never given her sons a funeral. A funeral was proof, indisputable. A funeral meant admitting that your boys were absolutely dead and buried. It was a betrayal. No funeral meant that one day they might waltz into the kitchen and ask what was for dinner and laugh with her about that silly mistake which had led her to believe for a moment. Imagine that they're gone forever. She considered her words carefully. "Sweetheart, Lucy's not dead." Isabel seemed to shrug off the comment, and her mother frowned. "None of this is your fault, dear. I'll never forgive that man." "I thought he loved me, Mum. He told me I was the most precious thing in the world to him, and then he did such a dreadful thing." Later, as Violet polished the silver frames of the pictures of her sons, she went over the situation in her mind for the umpteenth time. Once a child gets into your heart, there's no right or wrong about it. She'd known women give birth to children fathered by husbands they detested, or worse, men who'd forced themselves on them. and the women had loved the child fiercely, all the while hating the brute who had sired it. There's no defending yourself from love for a baby, Violet knew too well. Chapter 29.
Why are you protecting her?
The question arrested Tom, who eyed Ralph warily through the bars.
Plain as the nose on your bloody face, mate. As soon as I mentioned Isabel, you go all queer and make no sense.
I should have protected her better. Protected her from me.
Don't talk, Bilge.
You've been a good friend to me, Ralph, but there's a lot about me you don't know.
And there's a lot about you I do, boy.
Tom stood up. Did the engine get sorted out? Louis said you'd been having problems with it. Ralph looked at him carefully.
Oh, it's not looking good.
She served you well over the years, that boat.
Yep, I've always trusted her and I didn't ever think she'd let me down.
Fremantle wants to be commissioner. He looked Tom in the eye.
We're all dead soon enough. Who are you to throw away the best years of your life?
Best years of my life were over a long time ago, Ralph.
That's codswallop and you know it. It's about time you got on your feet and did something. For Christ's sake, wake up to your bloody self.
What are you suggesting I do, Ralph?
I'm suggesting you tell the bloody truth, whatever it is. The only place lying leads is trouble.
Sometimes it's the only place telling the truth gets you too.
People can only take so much, Ralph.
Christ. I know that better than anyone. Izzy was just an ordinary, happy girl until she got tangled up with me. None of this would have happened if she hadn't come out to Janus. She thought it'd be paradise. She had no idea what she was in for. Should never have let her come out. She's a graying woman, Tom.
He looked at the skipper, weighing his next words. Ralph, I've had this coming a long time. Sins catch up with you in the end.
He sighed and looked up at a spider web in the corner of his cell, where a few flies hung like forlorn Christmas decorations.
I should have been dead years ago. God knows I should have copped a bullet or a bayonet 100 times over. Been on borrowed time a long while.
He swallowed hard.
It's tough enough on his being that Lucy.
She'd never survive time and... Ralph, this is the one thing I can do for her. It's as close to making it up to her as I'll ever get.
It's not fair.
The child repeats his phrase over and over. Not in a whinging tone, but in a desperate appeal to reason. Her expression is that of someone trying to explain an English phrase to a foreigner.
It's not fair. I want to go home.
Sometimes Hannah manages to distract her for a few hours, making cakes with her, cutting out paper dolls, putting crumbs out for the fairy wrens, so that the tiny creatures come right to the door and hop about on legs as fine as fuse wire. Enthralling Grace while they peck daintily at the stale bread. When she sees Grace's expression of delight at the tabby cat they pass one day, she asks around town if anyone has any kittens, and a tiny black creature with white paws and face becomes part of the household. Grace is interested but suspicious.
Go on. He's yours. All for you, says Hannah, putting the kitten gently into her hands. So you have to help look after him.
Now, what do you think his name should be? Lucy, says the child without hesitation. Hannah balks.
I think Lucy's a little girl's name, not a cat's name, she says. What about a proper cat's name?
So Grace gives the only cat's name she knows. Tabitha Tabby.
Tabitha Tabby it is, Hannah says,
resisting the urge to tell her it's not a tabby cat and it's not a girl. At least she's got the child to speak. The next day when Hannah says, come on, shall we give Tabitha some mints? Grace responds, fiddling with a strand of hair. She doesn't like you, she only likes me. There's no malice, just explaining a fact.
Perhaps you should let her see Isabel Sherbourne, Gwen suggested after a particularly fierce round between mother and child over putting on a pair of shoes.
Hannah looked horrified. Gwen! I know it's the last thing you want to hear, but I'm just saying. Maybe if Grace thought you were a friend of her mother's, that might help somehow. A friend of her mother's? How could you even say such a thing? Besides, you know what Dr. Sumpton said, the sooner she forgets about that woman, the better. But she could not escape the fact that her daughter had been irrevocably embossed with the stamp of those other parents, that other life. When they walked by the beach, Grace strained to get to the water. At night, whereas most children would be pleased to identify the moon, Grace could point to the brightest star of the evening and declare, "Sirius, and the Milky Way," in a voice so confident that it frightened Hannah, made her hurry inside, saying, "Time for bed now, in we go." Hannah prayed to be freed from resentment, from bitterness. "Lord, I'm so blessed to have my daughter back. Show me the right thing to do." But straight away she would imagine Frank thrown into an unmarked grave in a piece of canvas. She remembered the look on his face the first time he had held his daughter as though she had presented him with the whole of heaven and earth in that pink blanket. It was not up to her. It was only right that Tom Sherborne should be dealt with according to the law. If the court decided he should go to jail, well, an eye for an eye, the Bible said. She would let justice take its course. But then she would remember the man who'd stepped in to save her from God knew what, years ago in that boat. She remembered how safe she suddenly felt in his presence. The irony made her catch her breath even now. Who could tell what someone was like on the inside? She'd seen that air of authority he'd adopted with the drunk. Did he think he was above the rules or beyond them? But the two notes, that beautiful handwriting, "Pray for me." So she would return to her prayers and pray for Tom Sherborne too, that he be dealt with justly, even though some part of her wanted to see him suffer for what he had done. The following afternoon, Gwen slipped her arm into her father's as they walked along the grass. "I miss this place, you know," she said, looking back towards the grand limestone homestead. "It misses you, Gwenny," her father replied. After a few more steps, he said, "Now that Grace is home with Hannah, perhaps it's time you came back to your old dad." She bit her lip. "I'd love to, I really would, but what?" "I don't think Hannah can manage yet." She pulled away and faced her father. "I hate to be the one to say it, Dad, but I don't know if she'll ever cope. And that poor little girl. I didn't know a child could be that miserable." Septimus touched her cheek. "I know a little girl who used to be that miserable. Fair broke my heart, you did. Went on for months after your mother died." He stooped to smell one of the old roses just past its full velvet bloom. He breathed the scent deep into his lungs, then put his hand on his back to straighten up. "But that's a sad thing," insisted Gwen. "Her mother's not dead. She's here in Partageurs." "Yes, Hannah is right here in Partageurs." She knew her father well enough not to press the point. They continued to walk in silence, Septimus inspecting the flower beds. Gwen tried not to hear the sound of her niece's distress so sharply etched in her mind. That night, Septimus thought hard about what to do. He knew a thing or two about little girls who had lost their mother, and he knew a thing or two about persuasion. When he had settled on his plan, he nodded off to a dreamless sleep. In the morning, he drove to Hannah's and announced, "Right, all ready? We're going on a mystery outing. It's about time Grace got to know Partageurs a bit better, learnt where she's from. But I'm in the middle of mending the curtains for the church hall. I promised Reverend Norkles. I'll take her by myself. She'll be right as rain." The mystery outing began with a trip to Potts Timber Mill. Septimus had remembered how his children, Hannah and Gwen, had delighted in feeding apples and sugar cubes to the Clydesdales there. The wood was moved by rails these days, but the mill still kept some of the old draft horses for emergencies when rain washed away sections of rail track in the forest. Patting one of the horses, he said, "This, young Grace, is Arabella. Can you say Arabella?" "Rig her up to the cart, there's a good lad," said Septimus to the stable hand, who jumped too. A short while later, he led Arabella into the yard, drawing a sulky. Septimus hoisted Grace onto the seat before climbing up beside her. "Let's have an explore, shall we?" he said, and gave a giddy up to the old horse's reins. Grace had never seen such a big horse. She had never been in a real forest. The closest she had got was her ill-starred adventure in the scrubland behind the Graysmarks' house.